Good morning. This is W.W. Chaplin in the NBC newsroom in New York, bringing you your world news roundup with direct reports from NBC observers overseas. There's bad news for the Japs this morning, and the news is told by Tokyo. The Japanese radio there says we've sent 1,000 planes against the enemy island of Formosa, raked it from end to end for hours on end. Invasion there would bring us closer to the Philippines, closer to China, far closer to the home islands of Japan. In Europe, well, Russian and Romanian forces are running wild in Hungary. That unrepentant Nazi satellite seems on the very verge of a military knockout. Latest gains in Italy are made by Brazilian troops, whose active part in the fighting there we have been too apt to overlook. Two Brazilian columns are successfully fitting up pincers around the big port of Spezia. On the Western Front, the ancient German city of Aachen, held in siege by our First Army, is being ground slowly to bits by artillery and dive bombers. And now, a few words from your announcer.
You think you have it tough? Brother, you should be glad your job is digging for dough instead of digging a foxhole. This war costs money, not only for bullets and bombs, but for the little things a soldier needs to keep the fighting spirit alive. The little things mean a cup of coffee at the right time, or a cigarette, or a magazine, or a place to step into for a friendly word when he's 1,000 miles from home. So when you're asked to contribute to the National War Fund, dig down, brother. Dig down and give some of that money to the 22 agencies banded together to provide morale builders for your fighting men in service. That means the USO and the canteen services and many others who are helping your men fight the war. So dig down, brother, and give to the National War Fund when you're asked to contribute. And now here's W.W. Chaplin and your World News Roundup.
The big air offensive the Japs say we have carried out against Formosa throws the spotlight on a very interesting and encouraging feature of the Pacific War. Time was, and not so long ago either, when American invasion of an enemy-held island meant just one more island. We got what we went after, nothing more. That was the island-hopping stage of the war. But we're in a new stage now. The effects of our long and arduous island-hopping advances are cumulative. Where we are operating now in the Pacific, we get a sort of compound interest on every investment in assault that we make. Take this Formosa. It lies between the Philippines and Japan proper. Our purpose there may be to gain a big base for air and naval operations close to the home islands. But in addition to being so near Japan, it is still nearer to the China coast. Our purpose may be to gain a springboard for invasion of that coast, to establish an American base at Fuzhou, for instance. Then again, the purpose of the Formosa assault, if indeed that assault is a preliminary to follow-up amphibious operations, the purpose may be merely, merely to fill in our broken ring of bases around the Philippines, preparatory to invasion there. It may be any of those purposes, but by achieving any one, we automatically achieve them all. We've just about reached the jackpot stage of Pacific advance. If invasion of Formosa is our intent, and it certainly would seem to be, it's a place well worth having. Look at it on the usual geography map beside the great land mass of China. And it does look pretty tiny, but actually, it's as big as Rhode Island, Vermont, and Delaware all lumped together. It's normally the home of some 5 million people. In case D-Day for Formosa is close at hand, here's a pre-invasion thumbnail sketch so you can visualize the scene when the time comes. It's shaped something like a sweet potato and is about 200 miles long from north to south. Running lengthwise, there's a mountain ridge rising to almost 15,000 feet. The east side of the island is a ragged precipice, plunging right into the sea. But the west side is flat and fertile. Good ports, plenty of space for airfields, beaches on which invasion craft might land. The papers have fallen into the habit of speaking of Japanese-occupied Formosa, as if it was a recent Jap grab. Actually, Japan got Formosa by treaty from China 50 years ago. Formosa has been part of Japan ever since. And now, NBC in London.
Ed Hoffler in London. Latest reports from the area around doomed and blazing Aachen this morning are somewhat confusing. This because of what is termed a somewhat sticky situation to the east and northeast of the ancient town. That is, in the area where German reinforcements are being thrown in. But one thing is perfectly clear. The fury of the attack has in no way diminished. At dawn this morning, Allied planes again roared in to set new fires in the town. General Hodge's artillery again resumed its ceaseless pounding. The combination of the two is gradually turning Aachen into a ghost city, systematically leveling the houses, turning Aachen into a pile of heaped up stones and masonry. Late reports say also that American patrols entered Aachen during this morning. Whether they stayed to be joined up later by additional U.S. troops is not known. But again, it is known that pockets of German fighting, the Germans fighting like madmen, are losing their punch, but some even are throwing in the sponge, like punch-drunk prize fighters. And like punch-drunk prize fighters are dragging themselves from their strong points and heading for the comparative safety of the U.S. lines. One other report on Aachen is being broadcast by the German news agency today. Famous last words, the words of the German commander at Aachen, according to the enemy. He is quoted as giving the U.S. officers who demanded his surrender something of a Teutonic brush-off. A town like Aachen, where the coronation of 37 German emperors took place, cannot be asked to surrender, not even by an American. That's a direct quote. To the south of Aachen, the morning communique mentions slight gains. Hard fighting and only minor changes in position are reported from General Patton's 3rd U.S. Army front. And down where the U.S. 7th Army fights, limited advances in the Vosges foothills northeast of Epinal. As for Holland, the sun is out again. An occasional cloud drifts slowly in a medium wind. The temperature is about 50 degrees. In other words, as one correspondent expresses it, it's perfect football weather for the second day in a row. But even 2 days of good weather don't make for good ground conditions. And we're told yesterday was the quietest so far on the British front, that today isn't much different. The Germans did, nevertheless, withdraw from the bridgehead they held across the Lech, placing a big chunk of the southern bank west of Arnhem completely in British hands. Farther south, Canadian operations are also described as less active, although the attempt to wipe out that German pocket near the Scheldt estuary continues. And the Canadian forces, this from the morning communique, are being steadily augmented by new arrivals, reinforcements. On this side of the channel, John Gielgud had a notable opening in Somerset Maugham's comedy, The Circle, last night, and Britons are being told they can expect a car costing about $800 once the war is over. This is Ed Hawker in London, now returning you to NBC in New York.
And we take you right back to Europe for another report on the fighting in a different sector. We call in now NBC in Rome.
This is Ralph Howard speaking from Rome. Except for intermittent showers, weather along the Italian front is cleared up and fighting is underway with renewed vigor. Two items in this morning's official reports may be significant. The first item is that the enemy facing the Fifth Army is making an all-out stand, fighting until killed or captured. They are launching an increasing number of counterattacks, and our advances are small. On the other hand, the Germans facing the Eighth Army are showing signs of withdrawing. British and Allied forces have advanced 2 miles against decreasing resistance. If you put these two factors together, it implies that the German High Command is fully cognizant of the danger to his troops along the Adriatic if the Fifth Army breaks through into the Po Valley and cuts off or threatens the main lines of communication leading northward. Thus, he may be fighting an all-out battle before Bologna, giving his left flank time to retire to positions where they can fight and then run if it becomes necessary. In Albania, partisan and Allied forces continue to mop up German opposition. So far, we've bagged 700 Nazi prisoners and a considerable quantity of enemy guns and stores. Improved weather conditions allowed our heavy bombers to get on the job again, and yesterday they went after targets in the Vienna area. Our mediums and fighter bombers were also active, attacking such targets as aerodromes in Czechoslovakia, Austria, Hungary, and bridges in northern Italy. For the first time in a number of days, our fighters were able to give close support to our ground forces, pounding gun emplacements and troop concentrations. Last night, medium and heavy bombers went after the rail yards of Verona on the northern edge of the Po Valley. Meanwhile, Allied naval units are active in the Gulf of Genoa, the Adriatic, and Aegean Seas, and the remains of Hitler's navy in these waters are gradually being tagged out. I switch you now to the NBC newsroom in Washington.
This is Leith Ead in Washington. And this morning, a New York newspaper admits out loud something all of us learn by sad experience every day, that no matter what you say about politics these days, somebody's going to get sore. So it's discontinuing its presidential battle page, where both Republican and Democratic National Committees had equal space, free of charge, to give their sides of the campaign fight. And the paper sadly observes, tempers are rising on both sides, to which we can all say, yea, verily. It's a lot safer these days to talk about the war. But still on a political note, the soldier vote, those absentee ballots from the foxhole precincts of Germany and Saipan, are beginning to come in. And right now it looks as if the GI vote may be heavy enough to swing the elections in several of the big doubtful states like New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Illinois, which probably will decide who our next president's going to be. In New York, for instance, where the Democrats have been criticizing Governor Dewey for his opposition to the federal ballot, just about 167,000 absentee ballots are in already. New Jersey, a federal ballot state, probably will have more. Pennsylvania expects over 180,000 military ballots, and Illinois looks for more than 350,000, enough to swing any close election. Ohio has already received 120,000 soldier ballots. In all, over 2 million GI votes may figure in the election, from some 6 million soldiers and sailors of voting age, I believe. The percentage of voters will be lower than among civilians, but those votes may allow the boys in the foxholes to name the winner on November 7th. Today, Governor Dewey reviews the Columbus Day Parade in New York. The president goes on the air this afternoon with a 10-minute non-political Columbus Day broadcast. And this morning in Washington, the word is that there won't be any breaking of the Little Steel formula to give labor a general wage boost until after victory in Europe, or at least until that day is definitely in sight. This is Leith Ead in Washington, returning you now to the NBC newsroom in New York.
So far this morning, we've had direct reports from these NBC observers. Ed Hocker is speaking to us direct from London, Ralph Howard talking from Rome, and Leith Ead speaking in Washington. Now, here's your announcer, and then I'll be back.
Waiting until the wounded are lying on the battlefield before volunteering as an Army nurse is a little too late. Volunteer now to aid our fighting men as nurse or nurse's aide. If you are a registered nurse, you are worth 10 bombers to the men in the fields of battle. Registered nurses are commissioned as lieutenants in the Army Nurse Corps. So if you're a registered nurse, enlist now. If you know a registered nurse, urge her to enlist now. The tide of battle in Europe is rising. With it will rise the tide of wounded. Your presence at a soldier's side when he's suffering may mean the difference between life and death. Send your applications to the Surgeon General, U.S. Army, Washington 25, D.C. Do it now, this very minute. Every minute you wait, a soldier suffers. Nurses are needed now. Wire or write your application to the Surgeon General, U.S. Army, Washington 25, D.C. today. And again, here's W.W. Chaplin in the NBC newsroom.
And now our questions from listeners. Mrs. Alice Newcomb of Concord, Tennessee, asks if next of kin are notified by the War Department when a wounded soldier is healed and returned to action. No need for that. By that time, the soldier is able to send the good tidings himself. And, says Mrs. Newcomb, do the slightly wounded receive the Medal of the Purple Heart as well as the seriously wounded? They certainly do, no matter how slight the wound, so long as it was endured in action against the enemy. And that includes enemy bombs or shells behind the lines. Mrs. Raymond Dunn of Cogan Station, Pennsylvania, asks if the blackout is really ended in London. Yes, really ended, so far as being enforced every night, regardless of raids. But the lights are still quickly doused when the sirens scream alert. And now, goodbye from the newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This is Morgan Beatty speaking. I'll be back in a moment with news of the day. The English poet Thomas Nowell once remarked, "Old winter sad in snowy clad is making a doleful din. But let him howl till he cracks his jowl, we will not let him in." Well, that was about 100 years ago when Nowell made his remark. But it shows he must have been the kind of a man who stocked up on fuel early. And that's what we advise you to do. There'll be less fuel this year, and as the weather gets colder, the fuel delivery problem will become more serious. So, if you want to be prepared for frost and snow, get in touch with your fuel dealer now and place your order. There's a couple of other things we want to pass on. Be sure your furnace is clean and protect your home with proper insulation. And finally, don't start your furnace until the weather becomes really cold. Now, if you'll remember all this and act on it now, you'll be comfortably warm during the months to come. And now from New York, here is Morgan Beatty.
The key to battles on the Western Front is contained today not in the battlefront headlines, but in a short dispatch from Washington. The War Department reveals that the United States Army Transportation Service, operating French railways, is now carrying more than 10,000 tons of military freight daily, and the War Department expects to triple that load very shortly. This announcement does not account for freight the British are moving in, as far as we know. And besides this rail traffic, American trucks are carrying a tremendous burden up to the front lines. The Anglo-American allies have been preparing for this great load for more than 2 years. When I was in Britain more than a year ago, I saw the great storage yards where American and British utility locomotives were stored, ready for immediate operation on French lines, built for that purpose. They were called utility locomotives because they are more or less slapped together instead of being built carefully to last a couple of generations. These engines won't last over 20 to 25 years, but they're perfectly good for the immediate haul in France. Many thousands of wagons, as the French and British call freight cars, were also ready for the operation in France more than a year ago. The Allies anticipated then that the Germans would destroy communications ahead of our armies or that our own bombers and artillery would wreck them. Hence, the elaborate system to replace French railways even to the signal towers and the bridges. But even 10,000 tons of freight is not enough freight in these days of tremendous consumption of munitions and the fact that armies on wheels consume great quantities of oil and repair parts. All of these play important parts in war. In any event, this short dispatch from Washington indicating that 30,000 tons of freight will shortly be moving over stable rail lines impervious to weather conditions gives weight and meaning to General Eisenhower's first news conference today in his new headquarters in France. The general welcomed Allied correspondents with a review of events, past and future. He said that while a sudden German collapse is always a possibility, he still is not counting on any such thing at any given time. The general said our armies would enter Germany as conquerors. There would be no fraternization with the people, but we will treat them justly. He thought the British 1st Airborne Army had not received enough credit for the brilliant flanking maneuver in Holland, the maneuver that drew German fire and saved the Nijmegen Bridge. The general said the fighting would continue unabated through the winter, if necessary, and that was the first indication we have had from frontline sources that the war could last into a spring campaign. There may be pauses in the Allied advances, he said, because of the desperate nature of German resistance and the Allied problem of supplying our armies. This was confirmation of our previous report to you at this time that the reason we did not overrun Germany on the first dash was the fact that our spearheads had outrun their supplies. Apparently, our armies are getting their supplies now, and surely they're going to get more in the future. The siege of Aachen continues today unabated. Our heavy artillery is hurling ton after ton of shells into the ancient German city. Don Whitehead, writing his story of the bombardment of Aachen on the field, says that our infantry moved forward this morning against the city on two sides. Says Whitehead, after the Germans had failed yesterday and last night, either to reinforce or relieve the besieged German garrison there, the fighting continued again this morning. General Courtney Hodges' doughboys attacked while the heavy artillery was still at its work. The infantry charges seemingly prohibited close bombardment from the air, although some dive bombers did scream in and drop their loads. Under a bright sun, says Whitehead, Aachen today lay like a festering sore back of the path of the First Army. From a ridgetop overlooking the city, we can see, he says, fire and smoke boiling up from the exploding shells and bombs and from wrecked buildings. A high-ranking officer tells us the Nazi garrison of perhaps 1,500 men is hiding in ancient caves, sewers, and basements, all impregnable to air attack and artillery, too. But, adds the commander, we'll take it. General Eisenhower said today, incidentally, that Aachen had become a mere point of tactics. Its bombardment had no particular significance at this time. The local Allied commander merely decided that was the way to go about reducing the city. The Canadians, farther north on the Western Front in the estuary of the Scheldt River, are making steady progress today in their battle to unlock the Nazi grip on the approaches to the city. Elsewhere, there were few changes on the battlefront in the West. In Italy, there was some progress. In Moscow today, there were persistent reports that the collapse of Hungary in the Balkan area could be expected at any time. In the Baltic area, on the other end of this front, the Germans conceded that the Red Army was tightening its grip on the approaches to East Prussia, on both sides, in fact. Also in Moscow, Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia and the heads of both factions of the Poles are on hand to help Marshal Stalin and Winston Churchill work out a solution of that problem of Eastern Europe. And there was some optimism that this would be possible this winter. On the Pacific War front today, the Japanese report that 1,000 American planes attacked the fortress-like island of Formosa, the island that guards the ocean bottleneck to the Japanese Empire. The Japanese broadcast intimated, but did not actually say, that the planes were carrier-borne ships from our fleet. The three principal cities or towns on Formosa were splattered with bombs, the enemy said. We have no word as yet from our own Navy. On the domestic news front today, there are strong indicators that the soldier vote, after all, may be a tremendous factor in the coming election. In fact, election officials of 11 states, officials who cross party lines, incidentally, were quite willing to agree that the soldier vote could mean the difference between victory and defeat for either candidate, and this is particularly true in New York State. Here's how and why. Well, over 500,000 servicemen and women have applied for ballots in New York. The estimates of the number who actually will vote range anywhere from 250,000 to 400,000. Now let's look at a few margins of victory in New York in the past. Herbert Hoover won the state by a mere 100,000 in 1928. Wendell Willkie held President Roosevelt to less than a 250,000 vote margin in 1940. That's too close to be comfortable for either candidate. And from Bremerton, Washington, we have a report that gives us cause for confidence in the younger generation. Anyway, Governor John W. Bricker held a press radio conference. Young journalists, as well as professionals, the amateurs, were there. One young 14-year-old amateur said, "Governor, what do you plan to do in 1948? These youngsters have their eyes on the future." Now your announcer. I'll be back in exactly 60 seconds.
Winter is just around the corner, and winter is cold. And this winter, you're going to feel that cold as you never have before, unless you start right now and take a few simple but very important precautions. Number one, if you haven't already arranged for your winter fuel supply, get going on it today. This year, there'll be less coal, less fuel oil, less gas, so be sure of getting some now by ordering it now. Number two, check your heating equipment thoroughly that you'll get the best results from it. Make sure your furnace is clean and in good repair. And install one of the heat controls now on sale at most furnace dealers and hardware stores. Number three, protect your home against the loss of heat. Now, you can best do that by installing proper insulation, storm sash, and weather stripping. Number four, don't use your furnace except when you absolutely must. In other words, wait for really cold weather before starting it. Well, this all sounds a little dire and dismal, and that's just the way we intended to sound. If you want to keep properly warm this winter, get your fuel and make your plans to conserve your fuel now. Here once again is Morgan Beatty.
Often in the business of covering news, staying ahead of the story, we leave significant dramatic stories in the backwash of events. Actually, we bypass big news. Some weeks ago, I spent most of one of these broadcasting periods covering the robot bomb and its effect on Britain. Since then, there have been many robot raids that I have not reported. In fact, the Germans hit southern England last night with one of the worst attacks of the whole war. A year ago, when I was in Britain, we had to undergo only aerial bombardment of the old-fashioned kind. First the overhead roar, then the flak guns, then the whistle, and it was all over. Today, Britain has a greater war hazard, a more sinister weapon of fear in the airways. We are fortunate to have at our microphone here in New York Robin Cruikshank, director of the American Division of the British Ministry of Information. He came over recently with Prime Minister Churchill, and he stayed to renew old friendships here in America. He knows the buzz bombs, and he's felt the tremor in their wake. Robin Cruikshank, what were the robot bombs like?
That's about the first question most of my American friends have asked me. Well, first of all, they were uncanny to hear, a wild beating and throbbing that filled the air. The house seemed to vibrate with their passing as though it were the cabin of a ship over the engine room, you know. Worse than their roaring was their sudden silence when the engine cut out, and you ducked, waited, counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, waiting in a black suspense.
Ghastly. Well, how did these things look?
They were pretty fantastic to see, especially at night. They had long, streaming tails of flame that lit up the blackout. They looked, well, like some sinister bird of fire. The weirdest things you ever saw flying under the moon. But beside hearing robot bombs or seeing robot bombs, there was thinking robot bombs. They did have a habit, you know, of thundering through your mind. Their fiery tails lighted up out-of-the-way corners of the brain.
And that seems to be the point. You've struck the heart of the robot weapon there, haven't you? The thing behind it, fear. What about that?
Well, I wouldn't say fear. I wouldn't say fear because there was absolute contempt for the thing. I would say intellectual curiosity. One thing that struck me very much during those weeks of the ordeal was the number of women who said, it's an unnatural sort of thing. The thing, they called it. As though it was some supernatural evil for which there wasn't a word in any dictionary. The thing, just like something out of H.G. Wells or Edgar Allan Poe. It wasn't a bombing plane in their eyes. They had seen plenty of those. It was a monster. What people felt roughly was something like this. The old Blitz seemed, well, almost natural and human by comparison, if you can put it that way. You knew, at least in those days, that there was a man up there in the bomber, pitting his life against other men. But this is a machine without a man, a soulless, insensate thing, a mechanical monster spilling its load of death at the whim of blind chance. They felt, too, there was something foul and morbid and eerie about it all. It was just as though they had made up their minds that a machine without a man had a power of darkness and evil in it, darker than the worst of men. Here was a new species, a race of robots. Here was mechanized science running amok and riding the skies out of all human control. The mechanical had become the supernatural.
There's the phrase for it. Mechanized science running amok, riding the skies. But why did the Germans fail with their sky monster?
Well, it was a psychological weapon that flopped completely. Fortitude and courage and all the decency of simple people defeated it, as those qualities will always defeat the most hideous monster that can be conceived. But it wasn't hard for those who had any spark of imagination to see a grim portent for the future of us all in the flying bomb. People felt they were in at the beginning of a new cycle in human affairs. There was something strangely prophetic about these apparitions in our heavens. People said, if robots like these can come roaring and flaring at us in 1944, what monsters will the inventors produce next time? You know, it isn't much more than 40 years since the first fluttering flight of the Wright Brothers machine took place in this country. Men who aren't yet old men have spanned in their lifetime the whole amazing development of the airplane. The robot plane of this summer struck us all as a forerunner of greater and more grisly menaces if we don't do something about it. The terror of the flying bomb couldn't ever make our people quail, but it made them angry, very angry.
Thank you very much, Robin Cruikshank. That's all for now, and thank you. I'll be back at this same time tomorrow.
A long time ago, in his Song of Hiawatha, the poet Longfellow remarked, "Oh, the long and dreary winter, oh, the cold and cruel winter." I don't know whether Longfellow's comment was occasioned by 19th century fuel rationing or not, but his observation is immortal, and again, this year especially to the point. Because this year, there'll be less coal, less fuel oil, less gas to burn, and unless we stock up now, we're going to find during the months ahead that the winter is indeed, oh, long and dreary, oh, cold and cruel. So for those who would like to keep warm, here are just a few tips. Get in touch with your fuel oil dealer today and order your fuel supply. Make sure that your furnace is clean and in good repair. By proper insulation, storm sash, weather stripping, guard your home against loss of heat. And finally, don't start your furnace one day sooner than is absolutely necessary. Morgan Beatty is heard Monday through Friday. Tomorrow at the same time, keep up with the news with Morgan Beatty. This is the National Broadcasting Company.